Okay, welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me. Today is August 20th, 2025. And I hope everybody can hear me. I'm looking at the thing that says the sound, and it looks okay. So I hope everybody had a great month. I spent a lot of time mowing lawns and mulching gardens and harvesting, and to this year we had a really good crop of berries. We've probably got about 60 bags of various kind of berries, like aronia berries and currants, gooseberries, getting some raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, and now coming the grapes and more fall raspberries, all stored in the freezer. Have about a whole lot of pumpkins and winter squash coming, a lot of broccoli, a lot of onions drying, and just a whole lot of food processing. That's what happens this time of the year. So I hope everybody is doing well, and I put some thought into how I wanted to restart after a month off of webinars. And I came up with an idea, and I must say I'm not sure it's a good idea, but it's where I'm going to start, and then hopefully I'll get your feedback and see whether to continue. The first thing I thought of was that it would be great to really give an overview of new biology. What is new biology? What are we talking about with new biology? What is the principles that underlie the new biology clinic? How did I come up with these, or did I come up with these, or did I steal it from other people? Just what are we talking about with new biology? So that seemed to be the most reasonable subject to restart with, since it's really what we're doing here. And so then I had an idea just last week, and I decided to just write the first chapter and or the introduction. And when I write, I usually, most of the books, I write longhand like this. I'm probably the only one who can really read it, and maybe Katie, who transcribes it onto the into the computer. And that it just kind of slows you down and makes me think, anyways, before I write this, I have to think about it and make sure it comes out right, because otherwise you have to scribble at stuff. And so it seems to flow better. And then I had the idea that, well, why don't I just read the first section? It's about 4 or 5 written pages, so it's not that long. Now, I'm fully aware that one of the most deadly boring things that you can do is read something in a lecture or a webinar or talk. So I'm very aware that this might not work, and that I'm about to seriously bore people. But on the other hand, I thought this was sort of thought out and conceived, and then I had a chance to go over it a little bit. And I think I got it down in a way that I'm not sure I could do if I just ad-libbed and freewheeled it. And I might miss some things, and I might miss the thread. And I thought it would be a place to start. So I'm going to read the first, it's about, like I said, 4 or 5 written pages. And I don't think that's going to take the hour. And so then I wanted to do something a little more interactive and maybe a little less boring. Hopefully, it won't be boring, but it'll be interesting. So then I'm going to try, and I would emphasize the word try, to go to the live stream. And there's not a question and answer section that I know of. So I'm going to have to go to the chat, and it'll be the chat that's current. So as soon as I finish, I'm going to go to the YouTube live stream. And if you have questions, in particular questions about what you just heard, or clarifying, or comments about this, I'll go and get 2 or 3 of them, and then I'll come back to the Zoom and try to respond to the questions. And if there's more time, then I'll go back to the YouTube, go back to the current chat. And so I may end up missing your question. And if you could highlight it somehow with like questions, so I know that this is something you would like me to address, then I thought that at least that part of it would be a little more interactive and maybe a little have a little more life to it. I do hope that reading it will come out with the life that I hopefully put into this when I wrote it. And then I thought if this format works, it would be also a good challenge for me to then, during the coming week, that I would write the next chapter, hopefully also keep it short. And then in a 4, 5, 6 weeks, we would end up with a little booklet, which would be the principles of new biology. And it would be having been then read aloud, and then it would could be put into a written form, and that might be a good thing as well. So again, I'm not sure this is going to work. I'll get your feedback. Like if you everybody says most boring thing they ever did and everybody leaves, then I'll know not to do this again. But I'm going to give it a try and you'll let me know how it goes. Okay, so this is called Principles of New Biology. And I'm going to read it, I think, without interruptions. I'm not going to comment on what I say. So I'm just going to go through and read it. While there is good reason to be very skeptical of what is passed off as, quote, history, I am mostly going to assume some of the historical timeline is accurate. In the, quote, old world biology, in the old world, sorry, biology was the study of life, living beings, and the various ways life manifests. Fundamental to this understanding was that the living world is composed of separate species, a species being a, quote, replicating unit, i.e., cats have cats, dandelions produce dandelions, and monkeys don't produce offspring with giraffes. These species were essentially given to the world through an act of God, in other words, a miracle. The general understanding as to the nature of all living beings is encompassed by the simple phrase in scriptures, quote, "The word becomes flesh." What does this phrase possibly mean? What is a word? How does it arise, and how does it become flesh? These are profound and likely unanswerable questions, but we can take a stab at them. First, words or a word arises in something we refer to as our quote mind or sometimes quote consciousness. To a certain extent, then, it is accurate to say words emerge from nothing, or at least nothing material. But somehow we have the sense that we are the creators, or at least participants in the creation of words. Without people, it seems as if there would be no words. The next step is the words get either spoken or written somehow. If spoken, these words become sound. So, what is a sound? It seems to be some sort of a wave, an electromagnetic wave. And what is a wave? It seems that waves arise from a perturbation of a medium. You drop a stone in a pool of water, waves arise. You create a specific electromagnetic frequency in a radio transmitter, and waves emerge in the medium of the ether. Different frequencies emerge from the sun, again, perturb the medium of the ether, and create what we experience as light. It seems then that the understanding of our world and the living beings embodied in the word becomes flesh, is that some form of consciousness, something with a mind, first thought, or maybe conceived of various words, then spoke or converted the words into various frequencies, which moving through the medium we call the ether begat all life forms. This seems to be the old world, old biology way of understanding the essence and origin of life. It would seem to make sense then, or at least be a possibility, that each species was created out of a different word, or more specifically, words. In other words, frogs are a specific word, i.e., a specific frequency or perturbation in the ether medium as a whole. Then each individual frog has parts or organs, each formed by its own word, i.e., a frequency which then circulates as a wave within the whole, the frog. This seems to be a fairly accurate description of at least two of the most important, quote, old world ideas as to the nature of life. That is, in both Ayurveda and Chinese medicine, we hear about the ether, the electromagnetic medium of the earth, as the quote source or mother element. Ideas or perturbations in this etheric medium, working through the four differentiated elements, earth, water, air, and fire, together forge the physical manifestations we call living beings. This creative electromagnetic force, i.e., the word, is the blueprint or code for the individual organs and tissues and circulates from and through the various organs. Health is therefore defined as the free flow of unimpeded wave-like currents through the organism. Disease occurs when there is an excess or stagnation of this electromagnetic current. Diagnosis becomes reading the manifestation of this stagnation or excess as it related to the various organs, and therapy is simply restoring harmonious flow of the currents. These various therapies took many different forms over the long history of the old world, from acupuncture to herbs to using sound, breath control, changes in food, fasting, cleansing, and so on. All were different methods of restoring harmonious flow. In more modern times, traditional osteopathy, homeopathy, and the various, quote, energy medicines continued in this tradition of interfacing with the flow of the waves of electromagnetism as ways of understanding and restoring health. The important point here is that all systems of traditional medicine fundamentally agreed that life, living beings, are the result of some sort of creative action or force or principle. This creative force, in its quest to celebrate life, uttered words or signals that created waves in the ether medium of the earth. These waves gave rise to the four elements, who, working together, gave rise to the physical forms and manifestations of all beings on earth. Health occurs when this individual is in harmony or perhaps is faithful to its original word. Disease is when this blueprint is lost, forgotten, or altered. In that case, imbalance, stagnation, injury, and suffering arises. The suffering is simply a clarion call summoning the individual to recapture, refind the original word by which it was created. This is the essence of what we call new biology, really just another in a long line of ways to explore the enigmatic phrase, the word becomes flesh. Okay. And then chapter two starts with the title, And then something happened. And this took a lot shorter than I thought. So I'm going to go to the YouTube. And if people have questions, either about what you just heard or other things that you think are relevant to new biology, put them with maybe put question, and we'll start taking a few there. Okay, I got one question. Okay, this is jumping the gun a little bit. So obviously when the next section, which is going to be then something happened, is so the question, let me start with the question, is DNA testing accurate? And we're talking about paternity, crime scenes, etc. And to get to the punchline, as far as I'm no expert on this, and I think it has some relevance. There is something that they're testing, which is some sort of chemical, which has something to do with the identification of people. And I've also heard, but not verified myself, that there's a lot of problems with it. And I hear this because people send in the questionnaire as if it's their cat or their dog or the giraffe or something, and they get a whole different result. And if you lie in the questionnaire, you don't get the same result. Now, I haven't looked into how many cases that's true, but I have reason to doubt that that DNA testing is as accurate as we think. And then that brings up the larger issue. So essentially, what I just said is or put in another way, everybody is looking for the code of life. In other words, how are we created, or how did we get here? So I don't even want to use the word created, because this is where the fundamental split in the what I'm calling the old biology. So there's an old biology, and then there's what you might call the conventional biology, and then there's what we're calling the new biology, right? So when I say the old biology, I mean Chinese medicine and Ayurveda and Hermetic alchemical understanding and Egyptian mysticism understanding, all those kind of things. The way that people saw the world. And they saw the world as the code, the blueprint, the directions for the creation of living beings as being a word. In other words, as I said, some electromagnetic frequency, which is a fundamentally creative process. And now, if it's a fundamentally creative process, there has to be a creator. There could also be a co-creator, and people, human beings, could be in a co-creation role. And maybe that seems to be the case. It does actually seem to be the case. But we're basically talking about a creation role, something, somebody, some force, some principle, some being is the creative force and fundamentally understands the role of electromagnetism and is able to, by some way that I don't think anybody understands, but to create these frequencies, these waves in the medium, into living forms. And then, as we'll get into, this whole way of understanding the miracle of creation was upended through modern so-called science. And so now there's no creative principle involved, and therefore there's no creator involved. All there is, as somebody, a friend of mine said, in the beginning there was nothing, and then a car backfired, otherwise known as the Big Bang, and everything that is was created in that instant, just by the fundamental laws of, physics. So out of nothing, there was this Big Bang, and then everything was created after that. And then from then on, it's just all these created molecules. They weren't created, they just arose. They bounced and banged up against each other all through random chance, and that became elements. And then the elements banged against each other. They encountered each other also by random chance, and that became chemicals. And then those chemicals bounced together and all by random chance and created larger chemicals and larger chemicals. And eventually, this bouncing billiard balls, or whatever they then decided they were later, became DNA. And DNA then becomes the code of life. So we've gone from a creative electromagnetic force, which is the code that was created by a creator, to it's all just random chance of random stuff that was made, we don't know how, but through some bang that happened, and all of a sudden everything that is came into being, and then it randomly collided, and then you got elements and molecules and complex chemicals, and then proteins, and then DNA, and then a frog, and then a giraffe, and then Aunt Hilda, and then Uncle Fred, and all this happened. In a way, even though it was all by chance, the Uncle Fred and Aunt Hilda must have come at the same time. Otherwise, if there was only Aunt Hilda, it wouldn't work. So the whole thing would have been for naught. And then that's how we got here. So you can't emphasize, you can't, emphasize how dramatically different these two ways of seeing the world are. And the repercussions for all of us of seeing the world in one or the other way. Now, this question about DNA, so then we have this chemical, which is the code, which is allegedly there to make the proteins, even though there's so many problems with that theory about the DNA making the proteins that make us, like there's just allegedly 200,000 proteins and only 20,000 genes, which are the component, and we've talked a lot about this. So it's clear to me that there is no possibility of DNA being the code of life. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a chemical which is somehow called DNA, which has something to do with fingerprinting, just like we have fingerprints, which we can more or less use to identify different people. So that may be possible, but I think the jury is still out on how accurate that is. Okay, so that's my DNA question. Okay, well, maybe we'll just do one at a time. I see one question here. Let me just look and see if there's another one. Oh, here's another question. Okay, so I got a few questions here. Let's go back. So the first one is, what is the role of heat? And we're talking sort of about fevers in new biology. What is the interaction of the heat on the gels? And interestingly, the person was specifically asking, why is there excessive heat when a woman is going through menopause? So that's an interesting question. I don't know that I've thought about that too much, a little bit, but I think I can come up with some sort of an answer here. So, one of the principles which we'll get into is, when you also read how this creative process happened, so we're going back to the creation. It seemed like this electromagnetic energy, this flow, moved across the waters of the earth and then created living beings out of that. And as we have found out, living beings are predominantly composed of water. It's if you look at it from quote molecules, then it's supposedly 99.9%. And if you look at it through like dry weight or volume, it's over 70% of us, and pretty much any living being is water. So the water is hugely important. And not only is it water, but water in living beings is in a special state, which is sometimes called structured or coherent or fourth phase or easy or organized water. It's a gel. And it's very easy to demonstrate that all the water in us is basically in this gel form, with the exception of things like urine and blood, where it's in a partly liquid form. But the water in our tissues and in our organs is pretty much all, if not all, in this gel form. And so, if you keep following, so what is a living being? It is a code, and the code is an electromagnetic frequency that directs the organization of the water into this unique and highly special crystalline structure, which is you. And so, my understanding of a species is all cats, all people, all giraffes, all daffodils, all dandelion plants have a common overall crystalline structure. And this crystalline structure, in a sense, allows them to resonate with similar crystalline structures, just like mineral crystals, like crystals are able to resonate with other crystals of a similar structure. And in a sense, that's the basis of their being a species and the basis of them being, resonant with each other, interacting with each other, and even then to be able to be creative with each other. And the most creative thing that a living being can do, people, giraffes, frogs, daffodils, is to essentially make a kind of copy of itself. In other words, offspring, children. That is absolutely a creative process. Interestingly, it starts usually with an idea, with a word. It starts in your mind. And there's some sort of an attraction if you follow the process. So that's like a resonance between these two beings. And then there's usually some talking. So there's some words that happen. And out of that comes the experience of love. And out of that comes commitment, hopefully. And out of that becomes a family, which is also a creative process. And out of that becomes children. All this is a manifestation of the creative forces that work in the world. And again, we're told there is no such thing as creation. So all these things that we just created, they don't really mean anything. It's just everybody for themselves. They're not resonating with anybody. We don't need families, and we seem to even not need to make children anymore, which seems to be what's happening. So all the things that we're seeing are direct outgrowths of the way that we see the world. Okay, so we're meant to have not only a combination of a species type of crystal. In other words, all giraffes share a common crystal, all daffodils share a common crystal, all people share a common crystalline structure, is what I mean. But in that crystalline structure, there are individual variations. That's why Pumpkin has a certain personality, which is very different than PJ and Fluffy and Lucy. They're all cats, they have a common crystalline structure. But they have individualized it and become their own type of cat, and even more so with people. And so this one person has a different individualized structure than the next. Now, again, health I would define as one's relationship, one's harmonious, fulfilling, or reproduction of being both a individual frequency, an individual crystalline structure, and faithful to the crystalline structure of people in general. So let me say that another way. Insofar as we retain and even perfect the crystalline structure of our gels of both the human blueprint code, which is the frequency of humanity or a giraffe. And then you have to be true to the individual frequency, which is you. Insofar as that's flowing properly and flowing through your organs in these channels called meridians and flowing through the three bodies and the four elements of the world, then you have a free-flowing, happy, harmonious, healthy life. But insofar as for whatever reason, and there could be a lot of reasons, anything from you forgot what the real code is, which is includes everybody, or your gels were poisoned, or you haven't nourished your gels, or you've had trauma and that has distorted your gels. You find yourself in a situation where either your individual or your species blueprint is not faithful to its real source. In that case, what we have is illness. And so then you have this question: how does this body, this original idea, the word that is you, both a species word and an individual word, how does it recreate the new healthier form, the new healthier crystalline gel? So you take this gel, which is distorted, and obviously, or at least as a possibility, one of the ways to do it is to use increased heat to melt the gel. So that it would s essentially melt, and it would be, it's like melting. It's like if you want to form a mold clay into a bowl, first you have to heat it, often with your hands, so that you can mold it in a better way. And so that's what we do. We have something that isn't right about what's happening with our life, either individual or our faithfulness to the species. And we use heat, i.e. fever, to start this remolding process. So we break down the gel a little bit. We often get a little part of the gel that runs out of us in the form of pus or mucus or cough or some other secretion through our skin. And that's just the cleansing process of discarding what was not helping us to create this perfect gel form. And then we have the possibility of recreating a gel, a crystalline structure that is actually more true to who we really are. So that's how the process of illness works. Now, what happens with a woman who's changing from a certain way of being, which is a way that has to do with reproduction and the creative act of producing offspring? And so now it's the time for a different kind of creative process to happen in her, maybe more to do with speaking out, or more to do with sort of politics, or more to do with writing, or more to do with just finding herself in a new way. So she goes from a, in a sense, a reproductive mode to a creative in a different, and one might even say, I wouldn't say higher mode, but it's just a different way. And so there actually has to be a remolding process. And with every remolding process, there has to start with the process of heating the gels so that you can mold it more effectively. It's very difficult to mold, remold, dry, hard, cold clay. So the first thing you do is to soften it with warmth and heat. And that's what we call hot flashes. And that is a prerequisite to being able to reform yourself as a woman in a new way, with new direction and new thoughts and new avenues to pursue, with to use your creativity not for producing children, but for producing something else in life. And in a way, that is the tragedy of modern medicine, is we see the hot flashes as an inconvenience and the disease, and we use chemicals which we allege that you're deficient in, called estrogen, or maybe natural doctors use progesterone, hoping you'll turn that into estrogen. And the goal is to stop you from having hot flashes, which means you stop yourself from being able to remold your individuality into this new creative way of being. And then from then on, you will feel like things just do not fit properly. I didn't become the person that my highest aspirations wanted. And so you're just off after that. And then what was meant to come into your life is not able to come into your life. And then one thing leads to another, and then you have worse disease. And that's why all these drugs that are meant to stop hot flashes end up causing worse things down the road, because they're fundamentally stopping a process which is the essence of the creative process of life. And so, again, New Biology understands, honors, and respects that these hot flashes are healing you, healing the gels, healing your crystalline structure, so you can form a new one that is more congruent with who you are becoming and the next phases of your life. Okay. This question is very off subject, but somebody asked about if they had a cavitation in their jawbone, whether that needs to have the tooth pulled or not. And I would say I don't know the real answer to that. I have struggled with dental questions, so I'm going to leave that with That would be a great question for the new dentist at our new biology clinic, Ron. He has years of experience with these sort of things. And one of the most important things that I think you can get out of having a visit with Ron or Mark, the optometrist, is just the question, is this something that can be healed? Is this something that you've seen that can be healed? Or is this a time where I have really no choice, and so I have to take the tooth out or have the cataract surgery or wear glasses or whatever? Because that you might find out that this nearsightedness that you're having can in fact be healed, has been healed in millions or thousands of people, and this cavitation may be able to be healed. It may depend on what the X-ray shows or how deep it is. And those are the kind of questions that they can help you with. And that is why we started this service. It isn't the important part of this process is not so much of the pulling of the teeth. That's sort of mechanics, and pretty much anybody should be able to do that. I know some do it properly and some don't, and they can help you with that too. But the question is this really my only option? And that question comes up so many times with so many different issues. Is this really my only option? And what we're trying to provide is, yes, that we haven't seen this. This is something that you need to do surgery or something else. Or no, this is something that we see healed all the time. Here's what you need to do. I can tell from your symptoms and your story and your X-ray that this actually can be healed. That is a huge service, and that's why we're doing this. The next question had to do with, does strophanthus, it is it possibly the cause of the cardiomyopathy, which means deterioration of the function of the heart as a muscle? And again, what the heart does is it expands and contracts, and it is should be able to do that in a spiral or vortex pattern. If the heart loses this ability to make the vortex, then it doesn't work as efficiently, and that's what we call cardiomyopathy, or at least that's one of the things. All I can say is, having treated thousands of people with strophanthus and looking through all the literature that I've ever seen on published on strophanthus, even though they say it's toxic, I have never seen anybody whose cardiomyopathy was a result of taking strophanthus. And my guess is, if it was, after 20 years of taking it myself, I would not be able to get off the couch, and that's not the case. So I'm going to try one more. Look at the chat. Okay, we'll do these three, and sorry I won't be able to get to everybody's. These are way off the subject, but that's fine. So the question is, I've talked about ivermectin. What about hydroxychloroquine and quercetin? And as far as I can see, these are all just different chemicals. I mean, quercetin is allegedly a chemical found in plants and even in the peels of different fruits. And so it's a quote natural supplement. But that word becomes meaningless when you realize that there is nothing besides nature. And so what really you're talking about is this something that is part of a plant or animal or mineral as it's found in nature, or have people somehow extracted chemicals from a plant or an animal and calling that a natural product because originally it started with something from nature. Now, again, I just to clarify, I don't want to say that there isn't ways of extracting active ingredients from plants. I mean, this was done by the alchemists, and when we make tinctures and when we make homeopathic remedies, we're basically extracting something from living beings. So I guess the distinction is whether you're trying to extract a single chemicals from living beings versus in homeopathy, you're essentially trying to extract the electromagnetic frequency. And when you make a tincture, you're trying to keep these frequencies and these codes as intact as possible and just transferring them to a water or alcohol or both medium. So there seems to be a fundamental difference, although maybe not a absolutely clear line of demarcation between the two. So what are they doing? Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, quercetin, and a whole bunch of prednisone. They basically are anti-inflammatories, and also you could say anti-metabolites. In other words, they decrease the energy that living tissues are able to produce. Now, when you do that, you could say that when you do this process of, I have this gel that's not perfect, so I need to melt it and then cast off what's not needed and then recreate a more perfect gel. That takes a lot of our energy, which is why we're tired when we're sick, and why when you fast and you're sort of intensifying this process, you want to rest and be and conserve your energy. It's also why, because I've learned so much from watching our animals, when you see animals that are sick, they absolutely go into a energy conservation mode. They often don't move and they often sit in a posture that conserves their heat, and they just sit there for sometimes hours and hours on end. And they're basically healing and they're conserving their energy to do this meltdown, reformulation, excrete what's not needed process. So when you come along with a drug that decreases your energy, which is what ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, prednisone, and I would even say quercetin do, they decrease your ability to carry on through this this detoxification, healing, reformulation process. So what you see is the heat stops, the mucus stops, the rash stops, the cough stops, and you think you're better, but all you've done is fix the person into their old disharmonious sick mode. They think they're better because the healing process is stopped. That's why hydroxychloroquine, for instance, is used as an anti-inflammatory in, for instance, rheumatoid arthritis. Your body is trying to recreate itself using heat, melting the gels, recreate a more perfect joint. You come along, stop the process. Now you have this imperfect code, this imperfect structure, and eventually it will not be able to heal. And the disease will come chronic, and something else will happen down the road. And most of the time, you won't even associate it with the fact that you took hydroxychloroquine, you took ivermectin, you took antibiotics, you took prednisone, and suddenly your acute inflammation that was a healing resurrection process becomes chronic asthma and chronic arthritis and cancer and all the rest. And nobody associates the two, but that is the problem with suppressive conventional medicine, and that is all they know how to do. There is nothing but that in conventional medicine, I guess, with the exception of surgery, where you basically take out the tissue that's offending the person instead of trying to reheal it or remodel it. So that's all these chemicals know how to do. And that's certainly the case with hydroxychloroquine, prednisone, ivermectin, and I would even say quercetin. The next question had to do with strophanthus again, and is it okay to take strophanthus with conventional cardiology medicines? The answer is yes. The only relative contraindication is taking strophanthus with digoxin or digitalis products. But as I said, the only paper that I've been able to find on that actually showed that strophanthus reduced the toxicity of DIG, which is a major issue with anybody taking digoxin. So I would caution people to use the combination of lanoxin, digoxin, or any digitalis product and strophanthus. They're both considered, quote, cardiac glycosides. So I wouldn't use that combination, but every other combination seems okay and it seems to work. And I'm not recommending necessarily that people take those other cardiac drugs, but sometimes there seems to be not much choice, at least for a while. So yes, it is safe as far as we know. And finally, somebody mentioned that my understanding of the heart has changed somewhat since I wrote the Human Heart, Cosmic Heart book, and what was I referring to? And that mainly has to do with the work of Manel Ballester and Francesca Torrent Guasp, who really was the showed me the structure of the heart, not so much of the chestahedron, but more of this rolled up cardiac band, which is there to create these two different vortices, which was also the case before. But just how this the structure of the heart came about, and you can clearly see that when you study the work of Torrent Guasp and where how the formation, the geometry of the heart was organized. And that, of course, leads to other understanding of how the heart functions and how the blood circulates. And so, in a sense, that led me to add, as he does, that the reason for the movement of the blood, the whole question around circulation, is what is the origin of the movement of the blood? And I've talked about the fourth stage of water dynamics that happens in the capillaries, and that is hugely important. But there's also a suctioning effect that you can see based on the looking at actually the anatomy, the true anatomy of the heart. The heart sort of vortexes down in a contraction and then contracts up, sort of like a plunger in your bathroom. And that helps to suck the blood up from or back from the periphery towards the center of the heart. So I don't think I appreciated the suction effect of the heart based on the structure of the heart being this band, which contracts down and it contracts up. That's obvious from the anatomy. The other thing that contributes to the movement of the blood, which I don't think I appreciated as much as when I wrote the book, is because probably of the iron in the blood and the fact that the heart puts the blood through this vortex. You get this very strong toroidal electromagnetic field that is emanates from the heart and it emanates 6 feet out. And you can map this, and that is the personal space that I talked about in the Fourfold Healing book 25 years ago. It's actually a band of electromagnetic frequency, and it comes about because of the toroidal field produced in the heart and the contents of the blood having iron. That's probably the true reason why iron or blood has iron in it, not to carry oxygen, which is not actually the case. It's to y be the strong electromagnetic field, which then organizes the rest of the body. That also attracts in a sort of magnetic way The iron from the rest of the body is attracted to this strong electromagnetic field of the heart, and that also facilitates the movement of blood from the periphery back to the center, meaning the heart. So those are the things that have come about. As I have often said, the thing when you write a book is that's when you start learning about the subject, because that's when people give you feedback and tell you all the things you got wrong. And it's a kind of humbling process, but it's also the way that we learn. Okay, it sounded like that the reading thing sort of worked, and so I'm going to try to write the next chapter two, which is then something happened, and describe how this model that was so amazing and so beautiful kind of fell apart, and then we'll get comments and questions on it. So I will see you next week, and I hope everybody has a great week.